Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, friends. Another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to keep on unfolding the ever-magnificent and fascinating journey into the fullness of consciousness. I was thinking about how language constructs reality and how the way we use terms and use terms thoughtlessly kind of get us locked into certain ways of thinking about things that we're not often aware of, or it's become difficult to be aware of, particularly when we're using words that are bandied about the media space and papers and politicians. And one really great example of that is the word drugs. You know, it's such a schizophrenic word. On the one hand, you say drugs, and it has this sort of negative criminal connotation, and it sort of becomes a basket within which to put all these very different kinds of substances and compounds, which may or may not include things like caffeine or alcohol. And at the same time, of course, when we need to buy some toilet paper or some aspirin, we go to a drugstore, although people don't use that term quite as much as they used to. And so it's a very slippery thing, and it's particularly slippery when you start thinking about this fascinating world, very rich world, very deeply woven into human culture and contemporary culture, especially the fringier aspects of it, but not just the fringier aspects of it. When you're thinking about psychedelics, a term itself which has its own kind of history, some people prefer the newfangled term entheogen, which means something like the God within. But I prefer psychedelic partly because it has a historical connotation. But what we forget about psychedelics, you think about psychedelics, you think about deadheads and hippies and maybe psychedelics used by shamans somewhere else, or magic mushrooms you can buy in Amsterdam, et cetera, et cetera. But we forget that, you know, before the mid-1960s in the West, that all those associations of sort of countercultural intensity and criminality and countercultural revolutionary energy were just really not part of what psychedelics were. They were being explored in a very different world, a much more elite world, a much more hidden world, but also in some ways a very, very conscious one. And that part of what happened when psychedelics became very popular in the mid to late 1960s and became associated with the counterculture was it pulled them out of this realm of very, in some cases, very earnest, very sophisticated, and very kind of compelling research, where people, psychologists in particular, were really trying to figure out how these substances could be used not only to tell us something about how human consciousness works, but how to heal, how to explore, how to expand. And reading accounts of those days of early psychedelic research, there's a kind of there's a very different vibe around it because it hasn't yet gone through the whole countercultural experience. I think that experience was necessary. I think it was inevitable that psychedelics would feed into the counterculture, or alternately the counterculture would arise partly in relationship to the intensity of psychedelics, to their ability to decondition you, to show you that there's another world is possible, and almost inevitably becomes kind of against the mainstream society. But then over time it evolves, things are complicated, shifts and changes emerge, and now we're in a very volatile, very interesting, and in some ways very optimistic period where the whole framework around psychedelics is changing. There's a new wave of research that's happening in America and Europe. There's an increasing sense that these compounds can be useful for healing, for both psychological healing and even to some degree a physical healing. There's been a number of studies lately about the disassociative ketamine as, really what looks like the closest thing to a magic bullet we have for severe depression, depression that, you know, goes outside the boundaries of any kind of therapy we can use, that there's some really positive effects that people in that state can have through the use of ketamine at a psychedelic dose rather than the sort of anesthetic dose that it's still used for medicines and operations. But in any case, this is all a way of saying I'm extremely happy to have our guest Jim Fadiman on today, because Jim Fadiman, stretches over all these periods. He was working back in the 60s doing psychedelic research in the sort of initial budding of the idea that these compounds could be extremely useful to human health, to human consciousness, to human creativity, and he's found his own ways through the ensuing decades, and has now just published Psychedelic Explorer's Guide: Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys on Inner Traditions, or Park Street Press, and an excellent book about set and setting 2.0, the proper framing of psychedelic experience in a therapeutic and creativity enhancing direction. So I'm really happy to have Jim on the show today. Before I bring him on, I'll introduce, of course, our co-host Maja Daou. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. And you were telling me that you just sort of seen something about James Fadiman on recently. You were watching something. What, you were inspired by something you'd seen about him?
Yeah, it was a DVD that was talking about some of the early research that LSD and hallucinogens were used for, which a lot of people forget. Everyone kind of, is familiar with some of the schizophrenic research, but in fact, it was used to treat alcoholics and people that were depressed and, post-traumatic stress, and it was used in this very healing kind of aspect, not just for psychological disorders like schizophrenia, which, if you talk to most people in popular culture, they'll kind of think like that's what Timothy Leary was doing and the early experiments were doing, but there's really not a lot of people that are aware that it has this other facility for actually healing, things like dependency and depression and stuff like that. And I really think that it's ironic that it goes into popular culture at parties where, people are usually drinking and stuff like that. And in fact, it has these hugely curative, kind of attributes to it. So that was one thing that I always got really interested in, looking at some of those healing properties of it, which was how I came into some of Fadiman's research on it.
All right. Well, that's a good way to bring on Jim to the show. Jim, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
It's a great pleasure to be here, particularly after hearing those wonderful introductions.
Well, good. I want to just jump right into it, because Maja's comment and some of the things I've been thinking about made me think about the difference, in a way, between looking at psychedelics in a healing manner, which is one of the things that's happening now more and more with the sort of rise of research and a kind of sophisticated way of looking at what happens in shamanism and what can happen in modern, settings such as the ones you talk about in your book. But there's also another dimension, and tell me if I'm wrong, my impression was that some of your early research in the 60s had to do with creative, the enhancement of creativity and cognitive work as well, which is something we hear a little bit less about now, but it also seems really, really important to me. So can you tell me about some of that research you were doing back then?
Let me just put just a quick context, which is it's hard to say what's a fringe element or counterculture when you're dealing with big numbers. But what the federal government says is 23 million people have tried LSD, and that 600,000 people will try it for the first time this year. So in my world, that sounds more like the culture. And one of the ways in which we found in the 60s, and I see it happening today, is people using these substances for high-level, rational, scientific, right-brain problem-solving, which people are fairly amazed at who have only used them for spiritual purposes or for having a fantastic time at a concert. And when we started that research, basically all the information said this is unlikely because these substances give you visions and psychological depths and stop you from being an alcoholic and give you visions of the divine and take you, in a sense, away from this world. And that's true. With the right dose, all that occurs. But I was working with a group of people, including some Stanford professors, and we were curious if, under the right circumstances, one could apply this mind-expanding, very general term, to hard problems. And we did it in this very simple way, which was we invited some senior scientists that we knew and said, would you be interested in bringing in your hardest problem that you're currently working on, and we'll see if we can help you make progress. And this was before LSD was available anywhere on the street. This was still all government-sponsored research. And so they came in, and we set up what's called a very friendly, supportive, safe atmosphere. They told us about the kind of problems they were working on in physics, in mechanical design, in architecture, and then we gave them a moderate dose, which was about 100 micrograms of LSD or 200 milligrams of mescaline, had them rest and relax and listen to music for a few hours, and then get to work on their problems. And what we found initially, to really our amazement, is it worked beyond our wildest expectations, that people just dug into problems that they had been unable to solve, because that was one of our criteria. You had to have worked on it a couple of months and been unable to make progress, been frustrated. If this was things for a client or for a company, that they had turned down all your ideas, something that really was important and hadn't succeeded. And what we found, and our measurements were kind of simple-minded again, which was, did it get bought? Did it get published? Did it get manufactured? Did it get patented? And the answer to all of those was very often. So that was the basics. And then we managed to get one publication out, and then the government actually stopped all research in the United States right in the middle of our study.
Hmm.
And it was an amazing morning where we got a letter from the federal government that said, we haven't funded you, but we still have the right to determine whether you can do this research. And if you have opened this letter, as of this moment, your research is terminated.
Wow.
And there were a few of us sitting in a little side room off of our treatment area, which was set up like a living room, and I was the youngest person there, and I looked at this letter, and we realized we had four senior scientists from four different corporations lying on the couch, or in the couches in the other room, about to start working on their problems. And I looked at everybody, and I said, I think we got this letter tomorrow. And we did. We got that letter tomorrow. We finished with that group, and the rest is a kind of hidden history until now.
Yeah. So how did you feel at the time when it was obvious that the main reason that the government was stepping in this way was because of the sort of emerging alchemy of youth culture and the spread of information and et cetera. How did you feel at that time about just the rise of this sort of counterculture reaction when you were trying to do work that in some ways was very much feeding, problems in corporations, problems to science. You know, you were like, no, we can use this for regular people who have intellectual problems. And
was it
conflicted for you? Because you were also interested in all the cultural stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I was a graduate student. And I was actually involved in two other groups. I was not only working on the West Coast through Stanford, where I was a graduate student. But I was involved with Tim Leary and Richard Alpert, Ram Dass, on the East Coast, who had originally turned me on. And I was also involved with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. But that was more, you know, more in the evenings and weekends. So I was very involved with all three levels of what was going on. And when the government stopped us, there was this feeling of, wait a moment, we're the people who are doing this totally appropriate, totally straight, totally benefiting the culture in obvious ways research. Why are you stopping us? And the answer that I came up with, and I imagine it really to be true, is there's this meeting in Washington, and a bunch of guys are sitting around who have never taken anything except alcohol and tobacco, and they're saying, we got to stop these hippies because they're getting a lot of sex and a lot of fun, and they're against the war. And everyone agrees that this is a terrible thing happening to the country, and that parents are frightened, and people's hair is too long, and so forth. And they say, well, we got to stop somebody. And somebody in the room says, we could stop all the scientific research. We control that. And someone else said, well, that's stopping something. And then they all said, yes, let's stop something. And so they stopped about 47 different research projects that day, ranging all the way from some very deranged scientist who used to give drugs to mice and then drop them in water and see how long it would take them to drown, real research, to us. So it was, I don't think we were even angry. We were not, it was too amazing to be angry. It was too, in a sense, ridiculous and sad, because here we were making scientific breakthroughs, and the government said, well, we're going to stop you because we can stop something, and that will make us feel better.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'm curious about how you, what you think about how these ideas of sort of, you know, creativity enhancement, intellectual acuity, what's the hidden story of those? Because, you know, from my perspective, looking back at the history of this stuff, you can see obviously psychedelics become very important with both a kind of idea of deconditioning yourself from social norms and also all sorts of spiritual ideas of encountering the divine, of the inner self, of you know, all this kind of stuff. But even within the lore, within the underground, for a long time, this story, the story of intellectual use, of the story of programmers, the story of scientists, the story of people who have found a way to integrate it into their sort of cognitive, productive life, is even that sort of like an underground story. So I'm just curious how you trace that as things go forward through the
decades. Well, the underground story continues because one of the things about scientists is they really aren't interested in the legal system when they're excited about a problem. And we had therefore turned on a whole bunch of scientists and let them loose in the community, and it became generally known that this was a possibility. And after the government shut down all legal research, of course, then illegal research blossomed in every area, and more younger, hipper people who later became, you know, PhDs and scientists and ran companies were using psychedelics both for pleasure and for thinking. So that if you really looked at the Hackers Convention, which was something that happened way, way long time ago with a whole earth catalog and the beginning of social consciousness, it was filled with people who'd had psychedelic experience. Then if you flash forward to the high-tech boom in the West Coast, where all these companies from Apple and Microsoft and so forth were exploding into existence, there was a huge amount of use of psychedelics among these people. And don't believe me or imagine it's one of my drug-crazed fantasies. I can tell you, and this will be not a secret to most of your progressive audience, there's a group of between 20 and 50,000 people who get together for a week over Labor Day weekend in the Black Rock Desert, and the amount of high-tech wizardry and artistic wizardry that goes on there is highly fueled by psychedelics. So while the government stopped our research project that we could publish and so forth and so on, people who are interested in exploring their own minds in order to invent, create, and make their lives improve seem to have been doing very well in all kinds of other situations. And I'm only talking about the U.S.
There are groups like that that meet, but what do you think, like, some of the implications might be if there was actually, like, an organized, cohesive, centralized idea that could... I mean, I know there's a lot of groups that kind of are making these factions and progressions and evolutions on their own, but, I mean, one of the things I liked a lot about some of the research that you were involved in was it was, like, concentrated and focused. And,
right.
I mean, obviously there's, you know, attributes to just letting whatever come in, and I think that kind of happens anyway. But, I mean, what if, like, you just get, you know, a bunch of people and concentrate on a specific idea under those auspices? Like, I mean, what do you think some of the implications of that are for getting, like, that organization and science into it?
There was an article in Fortune magazine, of all places, a few years ago, that fantasied putting an institution like the one we actually had on an island somewhere near Bali and inviting world leaders and business leaders and scientific leaders to come together and have psychedelic sessions the way we planned them to work on specific problems. And in the fantasy, it actually resembled remarkably what we'd already done. And the notion was that if you put a bunch of people who care about a problem together and give them the best tools available on the planet, you move the planet forward a lot more easily. And if I were running a country that, say, wanted to be technologically ahead of the game, and I had an important tool, I probably would try to use it rather than make it illegal. And just as an aside, there are at least two Nobel Prize winners who have openly described how LSD was pivotal in the discoveries that eventually led to their Nobel Prizes. And the one that's most fun is the DNA molecule, that double-twisted helix, as we call it, was envisioned with a low dose of LSD by Crick.
So yeah, it's really
already,
remarkable
in
also
sense,
to...
We're already doing it, and we're doing it kind of secretly and covertly and in a... And yes, and your question is a wonderful one. What if we did it consciously?
Right.
And I suspect we would do it better.
Well, what are some of the things you talk about in your new book is very practical. It's very down to earth. It's very, you know, grounded. It's not like lost in the sort of divine clouds. Even though you clearly can see the light shining through the windows. What are some of the things that you see or that you want to communicate to people about how to make psychedelics more effective in this sense, or more focused, or to raise the creativity and insight levels, and not get caught in the weeds, so to speak. What are the things that you really were trying to emphasize and bring forward today?
Yeah, I'd say if there's one word which appears almost in every few pages in my book, and I talk about all kinds of different ways to use psychedelics, it's the word guide. And it's the same reason you use a guide, because you want someone there who knows the terrain better than you do and can alert you of any problems and can help you if you're in any trouble. And as a result, you're willing to go farther, stay longer, and do more. It's it's like going to Africa, and the guide doesn't give you any experiences, but the guide can say, if we walk over there, we can see into a valley and there's 10,000 wildebeests running by. And similarly, the guide can say, you see that rhinoceros that's running at us? If I were you, I'd stand behind this tree. Now, that gives you the experience, but having a seriously trained guide who's there only to improve your experience turns out to be the critical variable. And it's the critical variable in our creativity experiments, it's a critical variable when people are using it for psychotherapeutic and self-exploration. And it's an almost necessary component if people are really looking into the larger spiritual questions. So if I'm any kind of fanatic on these issues, it's if something is worth doing, it's worth doing well. And the best way to use psychedelics is with a guide.
One of the interesting things about this idea of the guide is it helps explain that it transcends the category of secular psychology versus spirituality. Because you can go down to the deepest Amazon and you go into and if you find like the most authentic shaman there or whatever, is that part of the function that shaman is serving within some kind of psychedelic experience is to hold the structural role as a guide.
Right.
And the same thing, you go into a very psychological, secular minded, if still open to spiritual experience, but still very secular in its approach and thinking about the mind and how its model of the psyche. And in that situation too, you have a very similar kind of role. So the shaman and the psychologists within the psychedelic session both function in this very similar way that you can look at in both through both frameworks, if you will.
And this is absolutely true, and what's wonderful is we evolved the whole notion of a guide and a comfortable place, and also the use of music. And then, in those days, we really had no idea what was going on with real shamans. But as we've now discovered, and you're talking about it beautifully in South America in particular, what the shaman is a guide, and there's a particular set that works best, usually, for instance, at night. And there is definitely music, and there is lying down and being comfortable. And it's, in a sense, we rediscovered what people have figured out over the last 8,000 or 10,000 years. So far, so good in that rediscovery. And that's where my work is looking at how can we make guiding part of the way people are going to use these materials. And in some sense, people say, well, how can you be talking about things which are so obviously illegal? And my answer is, if people are going to do something anyway, it seems to be decent and moral and actually the role of government as well as us to make sure they do it as safely and as beneficially as possible. And for me, that revolves around guides.
Yeah, it's go ahead, Raja.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, I think if you go back through the annals of history, that concept of the guide is not always beneficial, and certainly that's where we get into all this conspiracy theory and mind control of how influential a guide can be on someone's cognitive process. I mean, you don't even need to get into, like, mesmerism and hypnotism and all of that because it's so evident. I mean, there's always this Svengali for the shaman and the witch doctor for the healer, but just that you can look at it in that way, in that if you do have a guide who has a conscious intention and a conscious objective that can be helpfully working out these problems in people's cognitive processes, instead of these guides that we can sometimes get that have this, sort of insidious way of influence over us, and even like how most cults operate, or, rock and roll, or you name it. So that concept of having the conscious guide there, I mean, that goes back into pretty esoteric stuff, like that's the daemon of the Greeks and that kind of higher consciousness that you can get to if you have someone helping you navigate,
Well, what you're pointing out is that there isn't any profession that doesn't have some rats in it. And I remember listening to one of the major gurus at one point who was talking to a few thousand people in Oakland, and someone said to him, "Are there bad gurus?" And he said, "Oh, that's a very good question. There are bad doctors, and there are very bad lawyers, and there are many bad politicians. Why would you not think there would be bad gurus?" And what you got is you still have to use your own intelligence and paying attention. It's a little bit like dating.
Right.
Is this a good relationship, or am I just turned on? And are we going in a direction that's healthy, or are we going in a direction that's increasingly neurotic and crazy and making me miserable and so forth? So when I say guides, I'm assuming, and I write about it in great detail for a whole couple of chapters on how to be a guide, it comes from an amazingly high ethical place. Certainly I have much higher standards in my head about guides than, say, psychotherapists, because you're dealing with more of the mind than psychotherapists normally get to deal with.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you, like in any other thing, you don't assume that because someone has a label or a degree or a shamanistic pedigree that they're only there for good. And all the shamanistic traditions, much to the dismay of us New Age people, talk about that there's dark magic and light magic. And what they're saying is these are powerful tools, and you can use them for kind of nefarious purposes or for beneficial ones. You know, remember that gunpowder was originally used for fireworks, and no one had thought about using it as to make weapons for quite a long time.
Very excellent questions. We're going to have to take a break right here, but we'll be right back. I'm Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking with Jim Fadiman, and we'll be back.
For the brightest progressive minds in the world.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Are you struggling to survive the Great Recession? Frustrated by everyone from the big banks to the politicians? You need the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown.
We bring common sense to the chaotic world of bank bailouts, financial crises, currency wars, precious metals, and government regulations.
Plus, we touch on many of the major news items of the day from a freedom-oriented perspective, and we aren't shy about our opinions.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Jake Towne.
And I'm Gene DiNardo.
It all happens Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you then, everybody.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No. Don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
Today marks the beginning of a beautiful friendship, because the stronger my heart gets, the stronger my pen gets.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis and James Fadiman talking about psychedelics and some of their uses for problem solving. James, I was wondering, you know, that ability to somehow unlock these doors inside of your brain for something like LSD, in your opinion, what is it? Because there are so many things in people's lives that they'll be so close to achieving something, but they'll be just like some kind of block that they just really can't get over, that's literally in their cognitive consciousness. Like they get so blocked that they can't even conceive it as a possibility. What do you think it is about the induction of LSD and a guide into the situation that can help someone literally like open that door? Like, what is the kind of mechanism that those two things allow to really like get into those like little mystery spots?
Sure. Now, that's a wonderful question, because that's really the central question of what do psychedelics do?
Yeah.
And Aldous Huxley in the 60s, when he was first introduced to these, suggested, and I think we haven't come up with a better image, it's that our normal conscious mind is like a reducing valve. It simply limits how much we can take in. And that's a good thing, because we need to function and we need to focus. And so when you're, say, walking down a street, if you're equally aware of everything in every store and the life history of every person you pass and the texture of each thing you step on, it's going to be really hard for you to just walk to where you're going. Just too much information. So we operate with a reducing valve. And what psychedelics do is they seem to release the valve enough so that you have much freer access not only to the outside world, but more importantly, to the inside world. And the inside world has all kinds of blocks in it, neurotic blocks and childhood blocks and prejudices and preconceptions and belief systems and so forth that interrupt the flow of actual real consciousness. Hmm. So what happens is the use of a guide basically is to make you safe, secure, and if you need something, to be helpful. The purpose of a secure, safe setting is to be comfortable and, again, physically safe, and it's not too hot, and you have water if you need it. The purpose of music is to take your mind off of the usual ways of working. And when all that's done, then the notion of the block is like a little teeny, kind of a little teeny dot in the road rather than something that you can't get around. And I remember in one of our creativity experiments, someone had brought in a graphic design problem, and the client had rejected something like 26 ideas over a period of months. And the particular designer was simply, when he looked at the problem, he'd just become unhappy. And he was totally blocked emotionally because he'd been basically told, you can't do this, you're a failure, you're inadequate, 26 times. Hmm. And what he said is, it was as he knew that was still all there, but it was unimportant, and he simply walked around it, came up with another 15 designs, picked three or four during the day that he thought were the best, went back to the client, and the client said, I accept all of those. Any of those will be fine. And so what we really saw is when you get around the block, you have a whole lot more consciousness there.
I think another thing that happens, because I'm particularly interested in this issue of technical use, because I've always been fascinated by the computer LSD connection, and so whenever I've met programmers who are interested in psychedelics, I've asked them about their use and what they'd heard about, and I've been kind of informally collecting a lot of this Bay Area lore. And I remember talking to one you know, very serious. You know, he designed hardware as well and chip design as well as being a programmer. And he was talking about the way that a lot of programming requires a kind of, you know, the program to build up a sort of map of a very complex, abstract, interactive, multidimensional space in their head, which then they have to translate into code or into some kind of structure on a chip or something like that, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that programmers stay up late and, you know, drink lots of caffeine, because they're building a structure that as soon as you, like, boot down the system, you're going to lose some of that complexity. And that psychedelics, particularly at lower doses, this fellow said and other people have said, enabled a kind of a richer engagement with multidimensional possibilities. It's like one of the things that results from those blocks and the filtering valve that you're talking about is it puts things in separate boxes. You know, this is over there, that's over there. They don't connect that much, because if they connect too much, there's too much information and I'm going to go crazy. It's like psychedelics allow a certain kind of richness of connection, of association. This is like that. This resembles that. This echoes that. That allows people to build up technical structures as well as, of course, very rich, imaginative, dreamlike worlds, which also run on this kind of associative connection. So it seems like there's almost a technical dimension to it, at least potentially, as well as the kind of creative unblocking that you're talking about.
Well, you're right on. And there's a term in psychology called the magic number 7 ± 2, which says how accurate psychology can be. And that thing, in normal consciousness, the number of things you can focus on at once is around 7. And this came out of designing the instrument panel for airplanes, where there's an enormous amount of information you need. You have to glance at it. And they simply found that if you had more than about 7 items the pilot needed to look at, they lost a few. Well, psychedelics basically increase that number to some unknown figure. And again, let me give you an example out of our study. We had an architect, and he had a project which was to design a kind of a one-block square area which would have shops and have an interior courtyard and be a pretty little chic shopping mall. And he looked at his blank piece of paper and he saw the mall, totally complete. And he said, I could walk inside my own vision and I could look at it as an architect. So I counted the parking spaces and they were exactly right. I went and looked at the inside where the beams were connected and saw the size of the bolts. It was as if it was totally constructed. And so he then made a whole bunch of sketches and was very happy, and we were very happy, and the client was very happy. And then what he said is, a couple of weeks later, having gone through this initial go-around with the client, he started to make, you know, the serious architectural drawings, which took him, you know, another week or two. And what he said of the serious architectural drawings is he never referred back to a single one of the sketches he'd done during the day with us, because he said, I knew that set of buildings. And that's about as complex as any programmer might come up with. Because when you're doing an architectural building of that complexity, you've got several hundred variables going, including, you know, cost, nature of materials, sizes, shapes, you know, ventilation, so forth and so on. And to keep all that in mind, in normal consciousness, is practically impossible. But it was easy. Sorry, Maja.
I always get reminded of, this sounds really dorky, but, you know, like in X-Men, the movies where Xavier puts on Cerebro and so suddenly he's connected to everyone, you know?
Right.
It's kind of like that. And a lot of what Eric was talking about with, like, the shapes and the structure, I mean, a lot of shamans will represent things, and there's that whole thing with LSD is like a grid, right? Like it's a matrix, like a grid. Yep. And it is. It's like you literally, through that, and that's when the mystic and spiritual come in, you have like literally a mystic experience where the connectivity of all things comes into a crystal clarity. So you come out of the singular and can, like, not just pay attention to everything in a building, but, like, everything in the United States. Everything in, like, you know, you go cerebro.
Well, one of the things that people, quote, call the mystical experience is the awareness that everything is connected. Now,
right.
If we just look at it like little logical beings, and I'm sitting in a chair, which is sitting on the floor, which is the whole building is sitting on the ground, and outside there's a path which is linked to some ivy and a redwood tree that I am aware of, and that's close to the fence that's the next house, and so forth. Everything obviously is connected. But we don't live that way. And the mystical experience is when all of a sudden you get it, that it is actually true that you are truly connected to everything else, that nobody exists in isolation, nothing exists in isolation, and it is actually connected as if there were little kind of lines of light that touched everything at once. And that is overwhelming, overwhelmingly positive. The feeling is that not only everything is connected, but somehow that feels really good or powerful, or like love is the connecting, you know, cord of the universe. And from that position, one can, and one comes down from that realization, reach with prayer or meditation or psychedelics, then the whole world takes on a very different cast. And things like problem solving become easier. Because in some sense, the knowledge to solve the problem is available to you because you're connected to it.
Mm.
So that the mystical and the practical are not very different when you are in the midst of them.
So I've been asking people on Twitter about what questions to ask, and this is a good one. Because just to set it up, we've been talking about the practical and therapeutic use of psychedelics. And one of the things that's happening now is there's more attention to psychological research and healing. Is there's this kind of idea of its therapeutic role, that it's good for you, that it helps you move forward, integrate, and then there's a sense of the importance of a healthy therapeutical model. But my friend asked here, is there a place for heroic recreational doses as well as therapeutic doses?
Yeah,
in other words, out of your going crazy just for fun, for mind melting, the sort of like crazy anarchic countercultural embrace of the weird outside of any kind of structure of this is good for me, this is going to help me with my life, this is going to help me, you know, understand the problem I have. I'm curious how you see that issue after being around this world so long and seeing and hearing so many stories.
It's a wonderful question, and the word heroic dose is something that Terrence McKenna put out. And heroic dose is some huge amount, whatever huge means to you. What we found very simply is if you give it's a lot of it is about doses. Let me just very quickly run through because we haven't talked about one whole area, is higher dose, 200 to 400 mics, leads to people having the capacity for mystical experience. A lower dose, 200 or so, 100, is psychotherapeutic in the right setting, and 100 and below is this creative problem solve we've talked about. There's a whole other level called microdosing or subperceptual or tenors, tenors being 10 micrograms, and that's something we may talk about. But let's go above the 400 mark and go, say, for us, I know someone who inadvertently took like 5,000 mics. And their report was really very simple, which is I have no memory of anything that went on. Because we, you know, when you overdose in anything, what you do is you get beyond where it's useful. And I determine useful is that do you come back with anything? And so because I sometimes do get this question, how about a heroic dose? And I'm thinking, what are you going to do with a heroic dose? Is get beyond where you have any capacity to know what's going on. Or some people who are, you know, macho say, well, I can take a big dose and I can still walk around and, you know, ride my motorcycle and so forth. And my answer is, oh, okay, fine, but what's the point if you're simply resisting it? And it's like someone that says, I'll drink you under the table, and they can drink more than you without getting sick. Seems like a waste of good liquor. And for me, to take more than you want for where you want to go seems like a waste of an important part of your life called that day. So I'm very much aware that people who take heroic doses usually are proving that they can do something personally impressive. But I haven't ever found anyone other than Terrence McKenna who said that a heroic dose gave them any insight or made any real positive difference in their life. And maybe the Twitter feed will now explode with, oh, you self-righteous jerk, you don't know how much I've taken and how terrific I am. And okay, that's fine with me, but I'm in the business of maximizing safety and maximizing benefit. And heroic doses aren't the best way to go.
We'll talk a little bit about the microdoses. That's a really interesting point that you address in your book as well.
Well, nobody seems to have written anything on it, so I'm very excited to be able to put out some of the first information. A microdose is exactly that. It is a dose that is so low that you and other people don't notice that you've taken anything. So the rocks do not glow even a little bit, and there is no little sparkle at the edge of the flowers. What you do notice on 10 micrograms, and what I have in the book basically is just a lot of individual reports because we know so little, is people function better at what they're already good at. What the people say is, I'm not more creative, but I'm creative longer and with more focus and with more clarity. And that seems to be what most people report. And what's curious about it is LSD, 10 micrograms, normally people talk about it's an 8 to 12 hour experience versus mushrooms, which is a 5 to 7 hour experience. What people report with a tenor is that they have two good days, 2 days in which they function better, they eat more carefully, they sleep better, they work better, and that it's about a two-day event. And there's a study being done right now across the country looking at that, and we're just looking at some of the preliminary reports. And when I say we, I'm not involved with the study itself because psychedelics is still illegal, but in the illegal world, people are interested in running their own research, and I've been asked to look at what they're finding. And so microdosing is also culturally safe. You know, it doesn't frighten anybody if you have a good day. And there's a wonderful line in the book where a woman is going to work, and she said she's just taken a microdose before going to work as a film editor. And she's looking around the subway car in, I think it was New York, but I'm not sure. And she's noticing what other people are having for breakfast. And she's looking at the kind of greasy junk and generally, you know, what us health food people think is terrible, having for breakfast on the way to work, and she wonders how many of them, what they would think of her having had micrograms for breakfast.
That's great. Well, you know, Jim, we only have a couple minutes left, so I also wanted to point out to people they can find out more about your career. We haven't talked about transpersonal psychology, fiction, and a lot of stuff, so that people can find out more at jamesfadiman.com. But with our last few minutes here, I was just wondering if you wanted to reflect a little bit about where you see things going, how you feel yourself as being part of this sort of phase that seems to be happening in psychedelic research.
Well, some people have talked about a psychedelic renaissance, which means after 40 years of not being allowed to do anything, we're now allowed to do a little bit now and then. And we're having some wonderful breakthroughs, not surprising, since it's a very powerful tool. What I see is that those 23 million people are not buying into the government's notion that these 23 million people all have had a terrible experience that may have driven them crazy. So when you lose faith in what the government tells you, it opens up alternative pathways. And we're now at a major turning point in the culture where we no longer really believe in what Congress says, what the president says. The reason the progressive radio exists is because we really have found that the major media doesn't report on things that are very important and very impressive. So I think we're part of a wonderful shift, a kind of return to let's see what happens when we open our eyes to more reality. You know, like the Arab Spring is certainly, they said, wait a moment, 40 years of a dictatorship, we're still here, and we're going to open our eyes and see what would be a better way to live. So I'm in moderate optimism, and that in the 60s, the psychedelic people said, you know, we're going to change the world because the world is such a beautiful place, and it's silly not to. And we may be coming back to that as what we're doing. And the ecology movement was fueled and driven by psychedelics, the peace movement, the women's movement, all those things were from that psychedelic era, and they're all coming back stronger. So I'm guardedly optimistic about
this. Well, that's
this.
Wonderful. It's just wonderful to have any kind of optimism these days, but I think guarded optimism is appropriate here. James Fadiman, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind. The new book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, out on Park Street Press, jamesfadiman.com. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Dau. Thanks a lot, Jim.
You guys are terrific. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Keep your minds open.